many times in the past, I've found a great deal of sympathy with the sort of analysis that this has given. The iniquity of the food mountains and the starving millions. The way in which business, the whole country is manipulated by financial considerations. And yet, on the other hand, I find myself in agreement with Bill in that the Socialist Party of Great Britain seems to have been plugging away for these 80 years and really not made very much progress. And so, whereas, of course, it would be nice to have this sort of utopia, I find it very difficult to imagine that everybody is going to come along and join in. I mean, it's worldwide. They have made the point that this has to be a worldwide revolution. We can't even convince well-meaning, well-educated people in this country, let alone convince the whole of the world, as to how this is going to come about. And I think my friend here said, can we put forward a view? And I would like to put forward the view that just for practical reasons, it's necessary to proceed step by step. And I think the step that the Labour Party has failed to take is to fail to distinguish between the different types of property. Now, I'm sure even the Socialist Party is not going to object to private property when it comes down to personal effects, one's clothes, perhaps even one's house. And on the other hand, the Labour Party appears to believe, or it says it believes, in the nationalisation of the means of production, distribution and exchange. It seems to me that this was a basic mistake. And what I think is the thing which nobody should be allowed to own is what government, the land and its natural resources. And it seems to me that if we concentrate on taking to the state the ownership and the benefit of the things which nobody ever made, which were just there and which the first occupants just walked in and took, if we nationalise or if we take it in steps and start by taxing these sort of sources of wealth, this is by far the most important first step in the road to a more equitable society. And perhaps I could just take a second point, because Bill mentioned about democracy, and we've heard the word democracy several times. How people believe me. Now, I do not believe that we are living in a democracy. I'm nearly retiring age now, and I have never once had a chance to cast a vote that could possibly count. I've either lived in a strong Tory area or a strong Labour area. And if I live in a strong Tory area, it doesn't matter what I vote, the Tory gets in. Now I'm in a strong Labour area, and it doesn't matter what I vote, the Labour members. So I haven't had a vote, and as far as I'm concerned, that's not democracy.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you've raised a whole range of interesting points. I'll try to deal with them in sequence, but very quickly, because there are quite a few of them. Firstly, you mentioned utopia, and let me say right from the start, Socialist Party of Great Britain doesn't stand for a utopia. So if that's what you're looking for, you come to the wrong place. We don't believe that there's any kind of perfect society that we can aim for. We're simply talking about a sane society rather than an insane society, which we're putting up with at the moment. Secondly, you say that even well-educated people don't seem to come across to our way of thinking. Perhaps the problem there is that some people are rather too well-educated. In other words, they've been too well indoctrinated by the school system in capitalism to be able to see clearly what their experience suggests. Thirdly, you say that we need to do things step by step, and I think that all of the examples I gave earlier show that this is wrong, that you can't, in fact, transform society away from capitalism and towards socialism step by step. The Labour Party has had 8 attempts to do this in its governments and has failed completely, and you can't do that. You either have to have one society, system of society or the other. What we've got to do, therefore, and I touch here on a question I'll be answering hopefully at greater length later on, which was put to me by Bill about tangible steps, therefore what we should be doing is building up, through arguments like these, in this pub, not just in the workplace, the number of people who are socialists and who think this way. Fourthly, you refer to what God made. Now, I don't want to go into a whole tangent about religion, and I'm sure you're aware that as socialists, we have no interest or belief in religion whatsoever. But the idea that certain parts of the world were made by God is quite false, of course. Maybe a figure of speech. It's worth stating, however, that even the so-called natural land and so on still had to be worked on by workers like ourselves to make it accessible and arable and so on. So even the most primitive of wealth needs that wonderful thing, labour power, the work of people like you and me, to make it something worth having. And you said that these things should be put in the hands of the state. This is your fifth point. No, as I said in the talk I gave, and I think the point is well demonstrated by numerous examples, no state ever has been, or ever will be, a body which can look after the people in a majority. The state, by definition, the police, the army, the courts, and so on, has to be there to defend a minority. Otherwise, why do they need all of those prison cells? It's because they're defending a minority interest. So you want to forget the idea of putting things in the hand of a state bureaucracy with its truncheons and its nuclear bombs, and instead talk about the whole of the world's wealth being placed in the hands of human society itself. And finally, you make, by my count, a sixth point about the vote not counting. If we can build up the number of socialists in society to a point where we can have a democratic majority, then it doesn't matter what seat you're in, it doesn't matter whether you have the present system of voting, proportional representation, none of these things really matter. If we can get a majority of socialists, then we can use democratic means to transform society, even given the present voting system is adequate. Provided we have an overwhelming majority of socialists, then that would not stop in our way. Finally, you say that the Socialist Party has been going for a long time, and you echo here a major point made by Bill in his talk. And we don't seem to have had any seats, as he put it, or success of one kind or another, and what are the reasons for this and so on. It's quite a mistake to say that this is because people are greedy, or in the way Bill put it, that socialism doesn't suit all of these many, many people whose lives are spent exploiting others. The fact is, a vast majority of millions of workers in this country are not greedy enough. When they go and vote for the Tory Party, or the Labour Party for that matter, what they're actually saying, far from being truly greedy, is they're saying, let's give the world to them. Let's have the coal board or the private shareholders of this or that company own the world. And let us, the workers, the wealth producers, give it up for them. Well, that's not greedy in my book. And in the same way, these people may spend their lives attempting to exploit others, but it's pretty petty. The fact is, people lead very frustrated, miserable lives, because the only real exploiting that goes on in society in any serious scale is exercised by the tiny minority I referred to at the beginning, as they exploit the vast majority of mankind. And therefore, what we need to do in order to win more people over is not to harp on the fact, as you seem to do, that the Socialist Party hasn't yet succeeded, but to ask yourself why it hasn't. And clearly, one of the major reasons why it hasn't is that people like yourself, who have some conception of the ideas we're discussing, have chosen not to throw in your lot with this movement and this party and the work, the day-to-day work of building up our numbers as socialists, but instead to make what I have to refer to as fairly petty criticisms, simply saying that we failed. Well, of course we have, because we're waiting to build up the majority of people for socialist change. And finally, I'm sorry it's a long answer, but you raised such a lot of points. Clearly, one thing is certain, that you're not going to defeat capitalism. You're not going to further the cause of socialism, as I've touched on it, by voting Labour or by persuading others to vote Labour. Because if you do that, what you're saying to them is, support state capitalism. Support reform of the system rather than getting rid of it. And clearly, in all honesty, you can't possibly claim that by saying that to people, you are in fact making revolutionaries of them and furthering the cause of changing society. What you're actually doing is encouraging an enormous diversion of energy away from socialism and towards labourism, which, as Keir Hardie said, are two very different things.
Yes, I'll try and answer in a little shorter manner, because the points you brought up, many of them have fairly simple answers. You mentioned, first of all, about you object to the manipulation of the financial institutions. And you went on from there to talk about ownership. Now, I have a fairly clear definition of what I regard as harmful ownership. People who own land to exploit society by use of the sun and the plants in the way of food. It's people who exploit the oceans. It's the sort of people who, normally those who are involved in ecological situations, object to. People like the Green Parties and various people who don't like the way the planet's being exploited. Well, I don't like human beings being exploited either. But you see, you're quite right, there are two types of ownership. There are people who own things and go out of their way to own things and retain ownership of things for purposes of power, so they can use that ownership and use the position they're in to exploit other human beings, or to exploit the oceans, or to exploit the land. And you know, they're putting the planet into a dreadful position because of this. But there's certainly nothing wrong, in my view, with a fella perhaps wanting a reasonable suit, or a nice motor car, or perhaps to have a nice house of his own. I don't think there's anything endemically wrong with somebody searching for something nice. And one of my criticisms of many political groups is they tend to forget that the average man in the street's also looking for, like, you know, a little bit of enjoyment in life, a little bit of purpose to his existence. And many people get this, the vast majority get this, out of their little bits of possessions, however poor they might be. I think there's nothing wrong with a person wanting to have their own house. I also believe that there is an answer to this. I believe that the land should belong to the state. I don't say the state as being the evil, it's always portrayed by certain organisations. It's the type of ownership you've got. It's the type of nationalisation you've got. Now, all right, if we're talking about the coal industry, the generating board, British Rail, there's faults. And the faults lie in the structure of the system. Because what I would like to see, we've heard the word cooperatives used, I would like to see more cooperatives in the real sense of the word, where those who work in the industry, whatever it may be, have some say in it, and also meet with those whose lives that they affect. So if, for example, you're producing something that the rest of society is relying on, they have also got a right to say in it. You can neither have worker domination, nor can you have capital domination. They're both wrong. Both forms of monopoly are wrong. And I, for one thing, would like to say whereby farmers were given the privilege of using the land and doing something with it for need, not greed, not so we'll get these mountains of grain and stupid things like that. We might be able to grow things that were useful. And people wouldn't have to worry about markets. And, you know, that side of socialism I've got every sympathy with. And I certainly take your point on that. Yes, because the step-by-step systems failed, it doesn't necessarily make the system wrong. It may be the steps that were taken were wrong. It may be the way it was portrayed to people that was wrong. It may have been that it was the people who were trying to operate it that were wrong. Because, you know, all human beings have lots of failings. This is why we kind of get the sort of socialism we're really looking for. Because of the inherent failings within human beings. And you kind of get away from them. You see it all around you. It's no accident that there's wars going on all the time. It's not all just because of capitalism. Because some human beings don't like other human beings. That's where it comes down to. And anyone who tries to get away from this, they're really missing out in the realities of life. And I think the only way ahead is step by step. And I only wish the steps that were being advocated were a little bit more positive, that were going to show some results a little more quickly, because I think it could be done. But as I've pointed out before, there are those who are not happy about that as far as an electoral thing. Seizing wealth. Well, there's only one way you could possibly do that in this country at the moment, in my view, and that is through the state. Because let anybody try and seize wealth at the present and see what happens. Because those who own it also own all the power. We've heard about the police, we've heard about the power of the state as it is now. It doesn't need to be like that. The state doesn't have to be like that. You could have a situation of more democratic accountability. You've been on about voting. I'll tell you a thing I've never been able to vote on. I've never been able to vote on which magistrates we should have in the locality. I've never been able to vote on which chief constable we've got. I've never been consulted on the type of policing I would like in my area. And all I want is to see full accountability for all people. That's democracy. The other thing they mentioned, which is a thing very near and dear to me, because if I remember right, it was in the first Labour Party manifesto, and that involves proportional representation. It's a ridiculous state of affairs, where we've twice had Conservative governments getting to power that have polled less individual votes than Labour. And we know they've rehashed all the boundaries and what have you to help themselves, but the fact of the matter is I would like to see a form of proportional representation, and I would like to see it done by means of a single transferable vote, which I think works extremely well in trade unions, it works in the National Union of Mine Workers extremely well, and in effect it means the guy that gets elected He's the one who most people want as either first, second or third choice. So if you've got 20 candidates, the bloke who gets the least vote, he gets thrown out. And the bloke who gets the most votes, he gets the job. And I would certainly like to say that. I'm sorry that the Labour Party throughout its history decided to ditch that. I think it probably ditched it when it began to get power, because the only people who seem to shout about proportional representations are those who don't have power. And I noticed that the Alliance now don't seem to shout about it so much. So I enjoyed your contribution. I think in many ways you put your finger on the paradoxes, on the problems, and you know, I've tried to answer you as best I can.
Chap on the front.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And agree with what Clifford was saying about the fact that we need an alternative to the Labour Party. And I think the fact that the comment that was just speaking last really epitomised what the Labour Party's really been about. It's been about the fact of a history of excuses of, if not this, it's problem of individual here, a conference vote there, or whatever. The fact is that the Labour Party was set up, quite rightly, as a capitalist party. And in fact, it still is the biggest block to workers' interest today, is in fact the Labour Party. And anybody on the left has got to really look at how they're going to oppose the Labour Party and how they're going to defeat the influence that the Labour Party has put on workers over the past few centuries. Because we're not just talking about defeating the Labour Party electorally, we're talking about defeating the influence that the Labour Party has had on people over the last 50 to 60 years. And it doesn't surprise me the fact that people voted for the Tories out of some kind of fear or whatever in 1979. Because what did people experience? The Labour government sent in troops to smash the firemen's dispute, supported the troops in Ireland, sent in British troops into other places in the world, introduced a social contract, and smashed youth with YTS scheme in that particular way. And that's just an indication of where the Labour Party is today. And really, its new glossy brochures offer nothing new. But where I do disagree, is the fact that the Socialist Party of Great Britain is not the only left-wing party that in actual fact opposes the Labour Party. The party that I'm from, which is the Revolutionary Communist Party, opposes the Labour Party, not just in ideas, but practically. We actually are, apart from the Socialist Party, the only party that will not call for anybody to vote for Labour under any circumstances whatsoever. We will never, ever do that in that particular way. But where I do disagree is the fact of where we're talking about how we're going to achieve that socialist society, how we're going to move towards a communist society. Because the problem is, we can't just rely on the ballot box. It's a nice enough idea that we rely on the ballot box, that we get enough people together, and that we just outvote whatever system or government happens to be in. But what we've got to remember is they've got the army, they've got the police, they've got the state in that particular way. And if we look only to Chile in 1973, where you had a government that tried to reduce by the ballot box, they soon had 40,000 tanks rolling down the streets and 80,000 workers lost their lives in a matter of days in that particular struggle. And the fact there is no way that the ballot box by itself provides any solution. Parliament is a part of the capitalist system. Voting was brought in as reform as part of the capitalist system, and we've got to remember that. The point is to challenge the values and the ideas that working people hold, the fact of the support of Labour, the support for reformist ideas, the support for racist ideas which divide workers today, the support for British imperialism and the interests of the British state that workers have today. And in fact, and to do that, what's really needed is to build an independent working class party, and a working class party that's not just going to propagate in terms of meetings, but it's actually going to take part in the actual activity on the streets, in the workplaces, in the factory, and actually opposing the Labour Party wherever it rears its head, which is why our party actually stands in the Knowsley by-election. Not because we've got any interest in parliamentary democracy, in the fact we think that's going to bring socialism, but to try and give people the fact that there is an alternative to Labour. Because what we're talking about is the fact that if Labour win again, we've got no alternative for working people. It's just as bad as a Tory government getting in effect, is what we're faced with. And the problem is that the way the capitalist system is going on, what we're going to be faced with is more and more of a gear towards another world war. We've seen the rearmaments that's going on. We see the developments on that particular side. And what we've got to do is oppose all parties that support the present system. But we've got to take that in an active and practical manner. And really what we've got to do is develop that party that fights against racism, fight against British imperialism, and fight against labourism, not just in meetings, but actually campaigns actively. And that party, really, is the party I'm from, whose paper, incidentally, is called The Next Step, and really argues to take that forward. And while we welcome discussions like this, we really think that the attitude is not just for discussions like this, but to actually take the campaign out so we can defeat labourism and we can defeat the system and actually build a revolutionary party that doesn't just talk about overthrowing the system, but actually can achieve it. Because power is there to be grasped. We've got to prepare for it, and we've got to prepare for it in the best way that we can, because they're prepared for it, and we've got to be more prepared than what they are.
Before I ask...
Can I just point out one thing? You were going to ask a brief question. The speakers are making contributions to the meeting.
Yes.
One thing, there's a chap here after the beginning.
That's right. I accept that. What I was about to say was that before I asked the speakers to respond, I was going to ask the questions, if you keep them rather shorter, because there are quite a few points that the first visitor had that raised quite a few points, and there's another few points here as well. So if in the future, before I ask Bill to respond and Clifford, if you could keep the points that you want to raise to 2-1, and we'll deal with them one point at a time. I see that time is getting on. So if you will bear that in mind when Bill and Clifford then enter the
program. Yes, thanks, John. It's interesting to hear that you advocate not voting for Labour. You didn't say who you were going to tell people to vote for.
The Revolutionary Communist Party.
Well, there are many places where the Revolutionary Communist Party won't be having candidates. I don't doubt that. You may have had one in Norsley, but you may not have them in other places. Now, I made the same point again as I made in an earlier answer. These ideas that we're discussing tonight are as old as mankind. Make no mistake about that. Philosophy has been put forward as long as man's been able to communicate with himself, which is going back many thousands of years. If you read back, you find that there was always ancient philosophers where these ideas came in, perhaps in different forms. But even if we only look to the recent past, if we look past, back to the last, we'll say, 50 years, where there's been great change of different types in this country, not in political power, but in people's aspirations and in people's lifestyles, you find that out of all the European countries, there's none has so often turned down revolutionary concepts than the voters of Britain. I can only remember a handful of communists, people like D.N. Pritt. There's another guy from Glasgow that was elected into Parliament. Now, you go on to say that you don't believe in parliamentary democracy, but you're going to have people stand for it. Now, you know, the word hypocrisy used earlier on tonight, I think that's perhaps the worst bit of hypocrisy I've heard. We don't believe in the system, but we're going to stand for it. I can't accept that. If you don't believe in the system, you say so, and you come forward with another system, you don't interfere with it. So I think, that's wrong. The Labour Party is the biggest threat to the left taking power. Well, whether that's true or not is debatable. But the Labour Party has, as I say, on a number of occasions, managed to persuade people to put it into power. So if there's anybody on the left who really believes that over the next 3 or 4 years, human beings who are no different now to what they were 90 years ago are going to be able to persuade the population to start having, revolutionary concepts and get enough people persuaded from the present system we're in to vote for that, I think they're anything but visionaries. Because I don't ever think it's going to come right. You're on about the problem of the state. And I answer you quite frankly on this. I thought it was disgraceful, and I would continue to think it was disgraceful, when any party that's supposedly or allegedly socialist, which the Labour Party says it is, and has certain socialist concepts, would use the army or the police against workers or against people in Northern Ireland. Yes, that one's answering. Simple answer for Northern Ireland, and that is there should be no imperialism left in Northern Ireland. You should have one united Ireland. And that's what the British government should be working for. And the sooner it starts doing that, the better. Because it's a mistake that was made in 1921 the wrong decision made for all the wrong reasons, and we've been suffering it for 65 years since, and so much worse for them of those in Northern Ireland. I don't agree with imperialism. I don't agree with Labour governments using the army and using the police against strikes. And I think that's something that could be worked for, and I think that's something that could be put right within the society we've got.
Well, Bill Etherington continues to take this contradictory position, where on the one hand he attacks everything the Labour Party has done and said, on the other hand he supports it. You can't really have it both ways. The Labour Party has used troops and police against workers and against strikers. They have, in fact, been set up at the beginning of the century as a trade union pressure group in Parliament to defend trade unions. And yet since 1900, what the Labour Party has done is to use trade unionists to abuse them and, in fact, to physically assault them on the picket line when it's been in government time and time again. And you've got to start to be realistic enough to grasp the reasons for that, which is that the Labour Party, to its very roots, is part of capitalism. Now, in contrast to that, to sort of complete the picture, I was going to say complete the double act, you have a member of a Leninist sect. In other words, a group of people who want to replay the Bolshevik Revolution, who want to persuade us that if we all start playing little Trotskys and Lenins, we can have a democratic workers' revolution by going back to 1917, the revolution in Russia, which was responsible for setting up a dictatorship because it was based on minority action instead of majority action. And it's quite interesting that he says that, unlike the Socialist Party, their recently formed sect opposes the Labour Party, not just in ideas, but in practice. Well, what is this distinction? That we only oppose it in ideas, but they oppose it in practice. What does it mean? Does it mean you go and rob their coffers? You actually take the money from them? No, it means you engage in ideas like we do. So that's just a rather silly argument. Now, you say you're interested in discussions like these. Well, that's interesting as well. Because when innocent workers, whose views you didn't know, were bombed to death in Birmingham 10 years ago by the IRA, and when the Revolutionary Communist Party unreservedly supports the IRA, and therefore supports the actions of that organisation, supports the killing of innocent British workers whose ideas you didn't even bloody know, but they're dead now. And that's the kind of organisation which has the audacity to come to a democratic meeting and say that he's interested in discussion. Well, maybe if a bomb goes off in this pub tonight, the discussion you're taking part in and supporting will come to a rather sudden end, thanks to the rather infantile and dangerous politics of fantasists who think you can solve the problems of the working class by blowing workers up who you haven't even met or discussed their ideas with. And finally, let me say this, that the Revolutionary Communist Party does make a very interesting case study of what happens when people take some of these ideas, these little theories, which go back to the Bolsheviks, a bit too seriously. See, the Revolutionary Communist Party has got even more laughs in store. Because Lenin, their hero, leader of the Russian Revolution, the model they want us to accept, the undemocratic sort of revolution, because Lenin had a pet theory about imperialism, which he stole, in fact, from an English liberal, from Hobson. Because of this, they have to follow religiously to the letter every word of their great master, Lenin, who happens to have been a very rich and very arrogant middle-class bastard who said that workers were too stupid to understand socialism and therefore had to be led and manipulated, as the Trotskyists continue to do. And as a result of these strange theories, you have specimens of literature like this, which comes from this sect, just happened to have it on me by luck. RCP, Revolutionary Communist Party, at the time of the bombing of Libya. Britain backs Reagan, we back Gaddafi. So that means that all of the workers in Libya who are being oppressed, who are being killed in cases, who are being imprisoned because they happen to steal something, you know, in Gaddafi's regime because they were hungry, can't be clearer than that. We back Gaddafi. Just as during the Falklands War, may surprise some people present to learn, but this fellow's organisation brought out a pamphlet. And what line did they take? Well, what's the average worker say about a thing like that? That's to say a worker who's not a bloody patriot, who's got more sense. But you oppose both sides. You oppose Gaddafi. You oppose Reagan. You can see these parasites for what they are. You oppose Thatcher, but you also oppose what was the leader in Argentina at the time called?
Galtieri.
You opposed Galtieri, just as you opposed Thatcher, because he's a fascist dictator, even if Britain was at war with Argentina. But no, they have some rather clever theories. They say that if your bosses in Britain happen to be at war with someone, according to Lenin, you've got to support those other bosses in Argentina because they happen to be at war with Thatcher. It's the oldest cliche in the book, an enemy of an enemy is a friend. Crass stupidity. And therefore, they brought out a pamphlet, which I've seen, at the time of the Falklands War, saying that the job of British workers was to support Galtieri, to support Argentina in that war. Whereas the Socialist Party has an absolutely unique record, which goes back 82 years, of having actively opposed every single war this century, even where in the First World War and the Second World War, it involved our members being locked up in military prison for refusing to fight in those wars. Now, presumably, if you think you've got to support the enemy of Thatcher, then in the same way during the Second World War, they would have had us, luckily they didn't exist at the time, they would have had us running around in circles supporting Hitler, because of course Hitler was at war with Britain at that time. And having put this point to these jokers in the past, you know what the answer is? Oh no, because Hitler at the time was leading an imperialist power, and Libya isn't an imperialist power, so you've got these strange definitions. If it's imperialist, you don't support it. But Libya, it's not an imperialist power, and therefore we've got to support it. Just like we've got to support Ireland, because that's not yet an imperialist power. Now the fact is, all of these old Leninist theories belong in the dustbin of history, and I'm glad to say that the overwhelming majority of workers may not have yet accepted the point of view of the Socialist Party, but I would claim in all seriousness that they're a lot closer to it, because we're speaking down-to-earth common sense. Let's have the world for the workers. We don't go around saying to workers that you should support Gaddafi or you should support Galtieri, because our bloody obscure theories tell you you should. So whilst it's all very well to oppose the Labour Party in practice, as well as in ideas, as you say you do, I think you want to think very carefully about pushing forward this Leninist sect, the RCP, as some kind of means of salvation of the working class. Look back over history, look at the democratic working class tradition which originates in the turn of the century, and think again about following these obscure theories.
First, we're always being told that the capitalists control the world and they control the state, they control everything. Yet how Anthony Sampson, in a book called The Seven Sisters, which is about the oil companies, the most powerful capitalist organisations in the world, in 1922 they were told by the United States government to get into the Middle East and start trading there. And according to Sampson, who is against the oil companies, they didn't want to do this, but they had to. How does this fit in with the idea that the capitalists control everything? Second question. I'm afraid it's a bit of an ad hominem one. The speaker from the Socialist Party has criticised Lenin. Now, I'm not saying Lenin should not be criticised, but I can remember a time when every Marxist absolutely worshipped Lenin. Yet now, tonight, we're told it was about the most reactionary character that ever lived. I would like to ask, how do we know that in 20 years' time, the speaker who said that will not be called the most reactionary character?
Well, just to deal very briefly, on the second point, you said that Marxists have always supported Lenin. Very simple answer. The Socialist Party of Great Britain never has. In fact, right from the early days, the Socialist Party was unique in recognising the direction in which Russia was moving. As early as 1918, we were publishing editorials in our journal to demonstrate that what was developing there was state capitalism. Amazing prescience, you might think, but not particularly, since we had a very clear Marxist understanding right from the start that to have a genuine socialist revolution didn't require a leader like Lenin, but required mass majority consciousness on the part of the working class. Could you just remind me of the other point about the oil, because it just escaped me for a second. Just
to the United States oil companies were told by the government of the United States to do something they didn't want, namely start operations in the Middle East.
Well, on that kind of point, the way this works within capitalism is that the state, or in the case of this question, the United States government, which at that time controlled the state apparatus, acts as an executive committee, a national executive committee, for the ruling class. And what that means is that the state or government have to make certain decisions which may harm certain powerful capitalists. But the idea behind it, and the reason that capitalists in general tolerate it, is that it will ultimately serve the interests of capitalism as a whole. So that, for example, in Britain you had the state at various points insisting on certain minimum standards, factory acts, questions of pollution and so on, which may harm an individual company which is hurt by that. But the idea behind it is that capitalists in general will prosper because it will exercise that control over the one bad apple in the bunch, which will allow business to be more smooth and profitable for the rest of them.
Yes, just very briefly, very interesting point you make about how history distorts things. You would make the same point about Stalin. There were many people, I believe, who were in this country, thought Stalin was a good man, and then they later found out what he really was. And I think you can say this. I think you can say this about almost every human being. I think history changes people's concept. I also think that it's very, very popular for people to become derided by those who follow them on. Because as long as the people who follow on have got to go on better, they've got to try and say, well, we've done this and we've put that right. It doesn't just apply as far as companies like Russia are concerned. But I'll make the one point about Lenin, because although it's probably correct to say there were people who recognised what was being done in Russia wasn't altogether correct. Some of the people were people like Winston Churchill. They thought what was going on in Russia wasn't correct. And so did most of the capitalistic states in the world. But the fact of the matter is, for the Russian people, and notwithstanding the fact that Stalinism later did become a blight in Russia, overall that nation prospered, and what Lenin did in Russia overall was good. And I don't think you can ever get away from that, just the same as what Garibaldi did in Italy was good. If you take the greatest good for the greatest number, and there are no doubt that the vast majority of the population in Russia did benefit and continue to benefit from the rising in 17. And I don't think anyone could deny that. It may not have gone the way people wanted it to go in later years, because the wrong people obviously got into power. But the concept, I didn't think was too bad, and I still don't. As far as the other question's concerned about the American government making the oil companies do certain things that they particularly didn't want to do, probably for short-term gain, I entirely agree with what's being said. Multinational capitalism demands that there will be times when certain of their numbers suffer. And the American government was obviously much more in tune with what was required for international capital than what the American oil companies were. Quite correct, that.